Good morning. Thank you guys for being here. I realize it's early and that you had plenty of other choices of things to do, like sleep. So we're glad you're here. I'm Carla Fisher. And
I'm Ann Richards.
And we're from No Crust Interactive, which is a children's game design firm. My background's in game design and education.
And my background's in children's television and general sort of narrative entertainment for kids. And now we've come together to make games together.
Yep. So let's chat.
So Carla's going to start things off.
Yes. Yeah. This had the unfortunate fun of
Don't say unfortunate.
No, it works out for everybody. Yeah. It was originally two talks that were turned into one. So I'm going to talk for a little while about the original, or one of the talks, and then the second half will be, Anne will have more participation in case you think I'm hogging the microphone the entire time. So the roadmap for today, we're going to talk just a little bit about why developmental psychology matters in game development, which is a piece that I'm particularly passionate about. And just out of curiosity, has anyone ever seen me speak before about this kind of stuff? Oh, that's awesome. Okay, cool. How many of you are game designers? Working in kids' games? Keep hands up. Nice. Okay, kid-ish games. Okay. And then, let's see, I don't know, education? Okay.
Some overlap, too, yeah.
What other kinds of things do we, who are like, just like...
Who are we missing? What do other people do?
Advertising. Okay.
Cool.
Government.
Okay. Ooh,
cool.
We'll behave.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Careful what you say.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Okay. So developmental psychology, then we're going to do a little crash course in developmental psychology. And in part, that's because it will benefit you to know, but also so that that way when we're talking about things and we say a toddler or we say an early elementary kid, we have the same reference point. Because for a lot of us, we have a fairly small sample size of kids that we hang out with. And so our views tend to be skewed of what that actually means. And then we'll get into the heart of the matter, which is how Left 4 Dead and other adult games, and when we say adult game, we don't mean XXX kind of adult games, but like the general audience sort of things, how those can inspire kids' games. And so when it comes down to it, really fundamentally, kids are different than adults. Cognitively, physically, they are different. And so one of the best ways to demonstrate this is actually, there's a great, basically the grandfather of children's developmental psychology is Jean Piaget. And he came up with these crazy tasks that are fabulous to watch and to just highlight the cognitive differences of kids. So I have a little bit that we can watch.
Can you look at these two glasses? Do you think that they have the...
It stopped.
Oh. Well, that's unfortunate. Can you look at these two glasses? Do you think that they have the... Oh. Okay. Well... Can you look at these two glasses?
All right, never mind. So I'll talk you through it, because that's why I have the picture there instead. So with kids, you can have, you put two glasses of water in front of them with the same amount of water in them, and you say, are they the same or different? Which one has more? And they will tell you they have the same. Then you take that one of the glasses, and you pour it into a tall, narrow one, and so the second frame in the picture. And then you ask them again, are they the same or different? Which one has more? And they will then tell you that the tall, skinny one has more. And it's a conservation factor of they're losing track of the fact that there's still the same volume of water. And this happens with bananas. If you cut a banana into pieces, they think there's now more banana than there was with the original single banana. And this is really in that like three, four-year-old range. And there's, if you Google Piaget tasks, there is scads of these things on YouTube. It's great. There's just all of these things, and it's really kind of mind-blowing to watch. And then you get ideas of things to try with kids in your life. And I will say, if you go ahead and you try some of these things with kids in your lives, if they are not your own children, if they are friends' children or whatnot, please make sure the parents either are not around or that they completely, thoroughly, fundamentally understand that this is a completely normal part of life and how kids develop. Because if a parent sees their child say, no, there's now more banana, because I've cut it into pieces, they will like freak out, go get therapy, it just goes bad. So it's really important to have the context of this is a normal part of development, but it's really fascinating to watch, and it's really important as game designers to understand what's going on behind the scenes, because if you go and you start it down an abstract path of this very like wonky kind of crazy game for a six-year-old, they may not even be able to cognitively grok what's going on. So also, on the physical side of things, there's very real differences in kids are developing motor skills. One of the best studies that demonstrates this is from a researcher called Juan Pablo Arcade. And he basically did this mouse tracking study where He put two about 65 pixel targets on the screen, and he tracked the path. He asked users to use a mouse to click on the one on the left and then to click on the one on the right. And so this is the path that the adults took. Very efficient, very clean path. This is the path that four-year-olds took. They're all over the place. They're like going off the tracked area and then back in. And this is just a great example of demonstrating like kids just are developing. They need a lot of support in how we build games. So it all comes down to really, as developers, if we don't take the cognitive and physical needs of kids into account, we're like basically throwing stuff out there. They might as well play with a box. Like, we have no idea what they're doing, but you can really start off ahead of the curve by using research and testing as part of your development process. And so really for us, this is an incredibly simplified model of our design process, but we're constantly iterating between design, testing, and research. All of those pieces are constantly informing each other, and that way we can use what's already out there to help advance our research, but then we can also figure out what we need to do additionally to understand that particular product that we're developing. And so just a crash course in developmental psychology so we're all on the same page about things. There are a couple of caveats that I do need to say before I go into developmental psychology. First of all, these are guidelines, not absolutes. For every time I say a four-year-old should be able to do this, there are four-year-olds who are like so far ahead of the curve that they're, you know, on the level of an eight-year-old, and there are four-year-olds who are so behind the curve that they're at the level of a two-year-old. And that's perfectly normal in child development. There are these huge ranges. I mean, how many of you have kids? Yeah. I mean, you know, like, especially in the early preschool years, the ranges are unbelievable, and it's totally normal. And so it's really important to keep that in mind as I'm talking about these things. These are guidelines. They're not absolutes. There are myriad factors that affect child development, from the environment that they're raised in, genetics, their gender, their culture, what they're actually taught. There's like all sorts of cool stuff around art that kids don't put horizons and skylines and ground into a picture until they're six or seven unless they're taught to do that earlier. So there's all these pieces that just affect how they learn. And it's just important to keep in mind. So, infants and toddlers. Screen media for kids under two is a very dicey area in general, and so I don't spend a lot of time talking about it, but it is important to acknowledge that there is a market, there is a space there, but moving into that space because of the APA guidelines that...
AAP.
AAP.
Right.
APA is what you'd use for...
It's the Pediatricians
Citations.
Association,
yes.
Essentially.
Yeah. But there's guidelines that, you know, there shouldn't be screen media before two. And it's a reality, though, that parents need it, and so many people have to balance that choice of, do we go ahead and make what parents need and risk that there's going to be people who come after us? So that said, I always talk a little bit about what's going on for infants, and really, it's about learning the basics. It's about learning how to walk, learning how to move your arms and hands and fingers. It's about learning how to talk. You know, at 12 months, a baby will understand approximately 50 words. By 2 years, they're learning 1 to 2 words a day and averaging 200 spoken words. So the acceleration in learning, once they grasp those basics, is amazing. 90% of children will walk by the time they're 13 months. By 24 months, 90% of children are able to kick a ball forward, jump, run, walk backward. So again, it's that, like, it's pretty slow, and then it just accelerates into everything. They use the pincher grip, which is that picture on your lower right. This is actually really challenging for kids to learn, and once they learn it, it's a main source of information because they're learning texture, density, the feel of it, and that's also why they taste everything, because that's another major source of information. So those two things together are really important for them. And then they also gesture. And so pointing, if you think of it, it's pre-communication, and gesture is incredibly important to kids who are learning to talk, and this is one of the reasons why touchscreens are actually amazing for kids. Because it's fostering their communication. It's assisting them in saying what they want to talk about. And there's even really amazing research that so kids will often, you know, they'll point, and they'll, when they're counting objects and they're kind of moving them aside, and we've all done it, especially when we're like counting change or something. If you stop a kid from gesturing when they're counting, their entire way of counting will bust. So they could be like awesome counting 1, 2, 3, all the way up to whatever, 100. You take away that ability, and you like hold their arms behind their back, and they're gonna be like, 1, 19, 42, 3, there's 4 things. And you're like, okay, there's actually 20, but So gesture is hugely important to kids. And that continues up into preschool, and it really continues for a long time. Preschoolers, now we're talking like the 3 to 5 range. And this is where really games can start to be really amazing opportunities for them. But they're very egocentric and very literal. They're learning through repetition, experimentation. That's, you know, the whole like doing it over and over and over again that drives us crazy as adults. It's really key to kids learning. They understand very simple cause and effect. They're using eating utensils regularly. They can cut on a line with scissors. They're walking in a straight line, which is actually huge, you know. They're starting to understand taking turns. They enjoy very physical humor. You know, wordplay is not a factor here. The more physical and just like, you know, just gross, not gross in like burping and farting, but gross humor of just like bonking on the head kind of thing, that's awesome. And they have a very basic understanding of time. One of the best models for explaining how preschoolers understand time, PBS Kids a bunch of years ago had an advertising poster. It was a clock, and it said how preschoolers tell time. And it was basically now, 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 all the way around. And that's pretty much it. They understand there's this thing called time and that there's later and sooner, but like it's pretty much all about the now. The early elementary age is really that 5 to 8, 6 to 8 range. And these are kids who are, you know, their attention span is increasing. They're still struggling to understand another person's point of view. So this idea of, like, what I see right now is very different from what you see, or that we're playing checkers and my goal is to get the black pieces and your goal is to get the red pieces. That's a pretty hard concept to get a hold of. So they're just starting to really master that at this level. Their focus is really starting to shift to refining gross motor skills rather than being about actually learning the various gross motor skills. And you start to see some of the gender split issues going on. And so at age 6, 68% of 6-year-olds have the same gender best friend. And then there's also a significant shift in media use habits. And so we're under 6, like maybe about half of kids under 6 will have played a video game. By the age 8 or so, it's like up over 75%. So there starts to be this really huge shift of kids just being introduced to games at that point, and they're really, in general, starting to consume a lot more media. And so finally, we're only going up to 12 today, incidentally. If you want teenagers, we'll have to talk separately. But the tweens are really that 9 to 12 range, and they're getting the beginning of abstract thinking skills, so they're really starting to be able to think about pre-algebra kind of concepts of what X actually means kind of thing. Their focus is fully on refining skills. There may be a few new things that they're learning. Girls are really beginning to show a strong preference for social games and social media at this point, and social activities in general, whereas boys are really going toward the first-person shooters, the like car racing games. Like that split is really noticeable there. They have a good understanding of time, space, numbers. They're understanding another person's perspective at this point. They may not acknowledge it, but they understand that it's there. In terms of their social network, I had said 68% of kids had the same gender best friend at 6. By age 12, it's 90% have the same gender best friend. And then additionally, their network, their social network has gone from being around at age 6, their social network is about 20 people. It's mostly caregivers, friend, or family friends, and then their family. By age 12 or so, their network is like 40 or more people, and that growth is entirely friends. It's not that they're accumulating 20 new family members, really, and that, well, some families are, but in general, they've really grown their friendship social network. So
that's now I get to stand up.
Yes, now I get to talk.
What can Left 4 Dead teach us about kids' games? That's the question of the day. So we know there are the set of mechanics and things that work great for kids that we all know about, that there's research about. But there's also this whole other set of mechanics in general audience games that are obviously really successful for another audience. So what we're interested in is, how do we take this lens of child development, our knowledge of child development, and look through it at general audience games and find things that can inspire us to really move beyond the sort of ABCs, 1-2-3s that we're all used to seeing. So we're just going to tear through a big list of games and talk to you about the things about them that inspire us and that we think are great for kids.
Got it. Okay. And now Anne doesn't get to talk. No. I get to talk again.
Kate, Carly is talking. I'm going to talk again soon.
So this is from Dance Central, and I just wanted to play some of the video.
Thank you.
That's right.
So I'm going to let it keep playing for a little bit because it's just funny to watch. But this is one of the best examples of kids playing together, which is a very natural part of how kids play. And it's one of the reasons I really love this is that the game has long ago given up of keeping track of who's playing, right? There's no way the Kinect has any idea which of those players it's tracking, but it hasn't punished them for it. It is just letting them play. So this idea of failing gracefully, so many of these, physically active, Rock Band, all of these games where you're like achieving a goal, it stops if you start crashing out too much. If you're like really performing poorly, it's like, nope, sorry, try again. This just keeps going and lets them just keep playing. And it's really fabulous for kids. So it's letting them play together without punishing them. It's letting them have a really good time. And so really that's one of the biggest things is to fail gracefully and then also to allow kids to play together. And I'm sorry, but you can watch this on YouTube, but I'm going to move on to the next slide. Did anybody hear what I said, or were you just looking at the cute kids? So in thinking about how kids play, nice, we got some ambiance now. In thinking about how kids develop their play styles, they always are playing together, but it develops over time. And so really the youngest, the ones and twos, you see this idea of parallel play. And it's where they're playing together, quote unquote. They're playing side by side, but they are actually not interacting with each other. And then they start to move into this idea of associative play where they're starting to talk to each other. It's very much one-on-one. Tempers will flare really easily because, God forbid, somebody grab your block. But they're starting to learn this idea of social negotiation and existing together. And then it moves into cooperative play, which is really around 3 or 4 years of age. And if you're like any of my friends, you need to practice cooperative play through the rest of your life. And so it's... And cooperative play is really about rules and sharing and fairness. It's about learning that, like, if I build a block tower, it's not cool to knock it down until I'm ready for it to be knocked down. And it's a developing skill that we want through all ages. And so that's where we've been spending a lot of time just thinking about, because there's great opportunities for cooperative playing games. So that's where we're going to talk through a couple of what that really actually means, though, for kids.
So this brings us to a game that's really clearly not for children, Left 4 Dead. But Left 4 Dead has a great co-op mode, and if you play it, good co-op modes, as far as we're concerned, foster communication. They require more than one person to succeed or to solve, and they encourage a variety of skills. You're taking skills from each of the players and putting them together to achieve a whole that you couldn't achieve by yourself. So if you watch, we're going to watch just a little bit of a gameplay video, which is sort of horrifying. But it's gonna, you're gonna see those three things happening, right? In any. So these dudes are running through a subway.
Oh, I think.
Or they will be in a second.
There we go.
And a really scary zombie is about to come out and start attacking everybody.
You should have said if you're afraid of zombies.
If you're afraid of zombies, you probably didn't come to this talk to begin with. But basically, they're covering each other, they're watching for each other. And once they get attacked, if they ever get attacked, but they will on the side.
See, and they're collecting, they're picking up their health packs. How many people have left for dead?
Yeah, okay. And how many, and have you all played it in co-op? Yeah.
Totally.
So. All right, here we go, chaos. But here you go. If you were playing by yourself, you would be dead. You know, you'd be long since being chomped on. Yeah, I think that's fine. Okay. That kind of covers it.
We've given everybody sufficient nightmares.
We've given everybody nightmares. Well, we'll give them some more with the next game.
Okay.
But basically, you're taking advantage of all the player strengths, and you're covering for each other's weaknesses. When you're hurt, you can change formation so someone stronger is in the lead and is covering for you until you recover. Sometimes you need to be more than one player in order to solve a level. And clearly, kids are not ready to see zombies' heads explode, and we're not suggesting that. But if you can get past that and think about what they're doing, they're really, you're working together, you're working towards a goal together, and you're communicating with your fellow players, all of which are really important skills for kids to be practicing. So that's Left 4 Dead.
So another one in this that's not technically a co-op game, but actually really falls into this category of being something that's nice to play co-op is Slice. Now, I'm really curious how many people have played Slice.
Oh, just me.
I thought.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you like incredibly masochistic, creepy games, I highly recommend playing this. It is, I mean, I was like on the plane playing it and I was cracking up and at the same time like totally horrified that I was cracking up. Here's how it works. It's an iPad game. And essentially there's these puzzle levels that are knives. And you need to move the knives aside so you can press the red button. And if you touch any part of the blade that would normally cut you, blood sprays across the screen, and there's this, like, gut-wrenching knifing sound.
Like the world's most terrible noise, yes.
Like, the audio design on this, on a side note, is fabulous. Don't play it, like, right before bed. Really don't. But, and the levels are evil. They get so hard, and you're supposed to technically be able to play this thing single-handed, and I swear to you, you need to use feet if you're going to do that as well, because it is just like, there's so many things going on, but it's a great example of a game that you can actually convert into a co-op game. And the thing about it, though, is if you're going to play it cooperatively, you have to communicate. And that social part of cooperation is a huge skill to learn of actually, like, not dominating the situation and being like, yo, you do that. It's actually talking about, oh, I think this one is going to do this, and just working together as a team.
Right, because especially on this one, if you're playing cooperatively and you're not careful, you're going to slice your friend's finger off.
Yes.
And that's bad for everybody.
So I definitely, this is a great one to just look at and think about. Super Mario Wii, or new Super Mario Wii, which is no longer new in any way, shape, or form. But, again, another fabulous cooperative game if you think about it in a different mindset. And so how many people have played New Super Mario Wii? And who's played it with four players? Madness, right? And so awesome. I like completely recommend it. But the thing that often happens if you're playing a game like this or Little Big Planet or you know any of these like big multiplayer platformers, you often end up in a situation where one person is dominating and is just like, you, go over there, get in a bubble, wait through this. And it really needs this modeling of cooperation, especially if you expect to use it for 8-year-olds or for kids who are trying to learn cooperation. If you just let them loose, one of the kids is going to dominate and just run through it. And then the other thing that's really nice about games like this is it really takes advantage of differing skill sets. So again, the same thing we were talking about with Left 4 Dead. There's, you know, people might be really good at jumping on the floaty cloud. Somebody else is really good at making it through lava or time jumps. And so that idea of different puzzles taking advantage of different skill sets is a really nice part of co-op. And another factor that often happens with cooperative games or intergenerational games, which are really hot right now, is just that the parent or the adult gets the short end of the stick if you're playing with a child. You often have to play at the child's level. And so I'm really fascinated by opportunities to actually extend cooperative or co-play experiences so that there's something that's at an appropriate level for the adult and at appropriate level for the child. And Super Mario Galaxy accidentally did this. In that the adult could be playing as the first player and like navigating this whole crazy 3D world, and the second player can just be sitting there with the other remote and helping to collect the star bits, where they're just like moving the cursor around the screen basically through the IR. And it's a really nice opportunity to operate at both of their levels.
And so back to Rock, or on to Rock Band, I guess we mentioned it briefly, but this is like the gold standard, right, of co-play for parents and kids. It's pretty much ageless. Kids can play with kids can play with parents, grown-ups can play with grown-ups, and it's just like all-out fun, chaos is good, you know, and everybody can be playing at their own level at the same time. And it basically can be hilarious for everybody involved, as the video we were about to show will evidence.
Play.
Hopefully. So if you look at the mom in the background, she can like she's trying to keep it together, but she's definitely laughing.
It's good enough.
throwing the mic out. He's like got some serious Rex Dharma. In short, co-op rocks.
And Portal rocks. How many people have played Portal? Yeah. And how many people have played Portal 2's co-op mode? Nice, right? It's awesome. It's about time. And so, actually moving away from co-op, as much as I love the Portal 2 co-op mode, Portal actually is one of the reasons, there's another set of reasons that we really like Portal. So for one, I just love their tutorial design. Like, it's very thoughtful. It's embedded. It's not like, yo, hey, you got to listen up to my instructions right now. It's just something that you have to play through, and it's kind of funny and witty and just, like, cheesy as you move through it. So that's a really nice factor in things, especially when you start getting into introducing more complex ideas. And then it's also this great, essentially no-fail environment. Like, you can wander around shooting stuff for as long as you want, building portals and just playing and messing around with the space. And that idea of exploration, if you think back to what I was just saying about how kids learn, exploration is incredibly important, as is trial and error and problem-solving skills. So all of these things that I'm talking about is actually the idea of STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math education. And it's another thing that's super hot right now. You know, we've moved from this, like, letters and numbers emphasis, and now, like, I think there's this movement toward just the sciences and the engineering mindsets. Really, at its core, STEM is about fostering a mindset of exploration and discovery. It's not about a rote memorization of facts, which is often the STEM education that most of us experience. Like, I had to memorize the periodic table of elements. That was a perfectly normal and part of a science education. But that's not at the core of what STEM is really about. Among other things, these are the things that are on the screen are the things that games do really well with STEM, which is cooperation, sharing and listening, and providing constructive criticism, trial and error and finding multiple solutions, collecting and visualizing data, and exploration and discovery. And so this next set of games actually are all in support of these goals.
So Angry Birds, which I assume everyone here has played, is very much a STEM game. It's all about trial and error. You're practicing multiple solutions. There are different ways to get through the levels. And you're learning things as you go, right? You're acquiring information about the birds, the different birds and what they do, about the different building materials and how you can knock them over, about how to best get that thing of TNT. And these are things that have certain qualities and interactions, and as you learn about them, you get better at the game and you get to proceed to higher levels. So that's a really important skill set for kids, to sort of that acquisition of knowledge. And it actually involves physics, so bonus.
Another one is Plants vs. Zombies, which again is another one with beautiful tutorial design. But also beyond that is this idea of shifting the rules of the game. And so I love the idea of achievements. And I love actually even more with Plants vs. Zombies that once you win the whole game, you can play that adventure mode again with a new set of rules. Where, like, they're essentially saying, all right, now we're going to pick two of the cards and we're going to restrict your choices. And so that idea of playing with the mechanics of the game and just messing with it is something that we all kind of do. Like, we try to game the system. Formalizing that in a way that supports the goals that you want to do is actually a great opportunity.
And so this one, I'm really curious. How many people have played Super Brothers? Oh, my gosh, very few. It's great. I highly recommend it. And what I love about this game is it's sort of exploratory within limits. It gives you these little missions. But basically, there's a reasonably small world, and this is an iPad or iPhone game, by the way. You can go around and kind of wander, and it doesn't really punish you for not doing things in time. It's all about encouraging you to explore this world and figure out what you can do, and figure out what combinations of these few simple things you can do are going to add up to you being successful. So an example of this is you're the Scythian. You're the little dude, it's a girl, actually, on the left. And you're wandering around. You get this mission that you're supposed to go release these sprites in the woods. And you know, because they've shown you once, that if you see little bubbles coming up out of something, it means there's a sprite in the neighborhood, basically. So when you see them, you stop, and you make the Scythian sing. And that's basically you just press on her until she starts to sing. And the music in this game, by the way, is fantastic. And once she's singing, basically you're just pressing things and playing around with the screen and trying to figure out what the heck you're supposed to touch and how many of those things you're supposed to touch or how many you're supposed to touch at the same time. And if you do it right, a sprite pops up and you've succeeded in capturing that one. And so I really like this game as a model because it's got a goal, but it's very exploratory. It's extremely non-punitive. And it moves at sort of your own pace. If you want to go get them right away, that's great. And if you want to sort of wander around a little bit, that's fine too. It's also really well written and funny. So
Minecraft. So back to the slate zombie theme. Minecraft.
Hands?
Yeah, not bad.
You guys have played everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're my friend.
You guys have really played everything.
So Minecraft is so open-ended and exploratory, and it's really about crafting your own narrative to a great extent. Like, yes, there's gameplay that you're supposed to do, but people have gone in and they've created all sorts of crazy things in this world that they've wanted to just explore and play with. It's kind of, you know, it's like Second Life all over again kind of thing, but with a little coolerness. Sorry to anybody who likes Second Life or played in there. But, you know, it's so open-ended. If you dropped an 8-year-old into Minecraft, like they would just be like, eh. So you need to guide the experience a little bit for them. But it's a really neat opportunity to essentially, sandbox games have as much value for kids to let them just play and let them create their own narrative and have their own world. Lego Universe is supporting this to an extent. Like, there are missions that you're supposed to play when you're doing it, but you can also just build stuff. And so there's like little meetups of people who have built Lego pirate ships in the world, and they're just showing off their pirate ships. And just this idea of creating a community around the tools of the world. And then the other thing that I absolutely am obsessed with and love is this whole idea of offline 3D printer extensions. And so Minecraft is supporting it. There's a few other cases of things where, like, you can print the game pieces that you're playing with in the world. And it's something that is, you know, really for the hobbyists right now and for those who have some extra cash laying around, but they're getting cheaper and cheaper, and they're becoming more and more interesting to play with kids. I have a really good friend who basically took his 3D printer, lined it with Saran wrap, filled it with frosting, and he and his son printed out all sorts of frosting game bits, and then they ate them. And so it's just that idea of being very playful and experimental with it is really neat, and I'm just looking forward to what else is going to become an opportunity in this space as it grows. Johann Sebastian Joust is also this really crazy way of playing with controllers. I know you guys have played it, so who else has played this? Not so many. All right, so Johann Sebastian Joust is this crazy game where basically you're using the Move controllers without the actual support of the PlayStation. And it's based on a folk game where you have your controller in this hand and you're trying to move it incredibly slowly. You don't want to move this with any force whatsoever. Everyone else who's playing is attempting to hit your arm and hit it so that it moves past a certain force point, and then you lose the game and you're out. And so you're walking around with this controller in your hand, and there's music playing, and that music indicates how quickly you can move. So it might be very slow classical music, and everyone's moving around like this, or it might be a little more upbeat, but the goal is ultimately for me to like sneak over and like smack Anne's controller to get her out. And so
without moving your controller too fast.
Without moving my controller.
Right.
And so people look like idiots when they play this game. It's hysterical, though, and there's some really great videos of it, and they're winning all sorts of awards for being like really just fun and outside-the-box thinkers about how to play with the toys or how to play with the controllers. And in a time where controllers have so many buttons and so are just so big for little hands, the idea of taking these and making other games that don't even really require the screen media is just a really neat idea and opportunity to just think outside the box, which I already said, but I'll say it again.
I'll say it again.
Goldwalker is another one that is actually a game for health. And it's just a nice visualization of data. And so it's a game that essentially turns your iPhone into a pedometer. It's hanging out in your pocket. You're operating in the gold rush times. And in order to move your gold that you mine to a town to sell it, you have to walk enough steps or shake your iPhone long enough to trick the pedometer or the accelerometers. You have to walk essentially enough steps to move to that space. So it's just, it's a nice visualization of how much you're walking. It's just a different way of showing the data. Groove Coaster does this too with music. There's a lot of these neat ways to take data and turn them into game opportunities.
And so one other thing we've been thinking about is Foursquare, right, as far as data is concerned. So this actually has a lot of kind of straightforward applications once you think about it. So instead of saying what bar you're at or what restaurant you're eating at, think about a kid taking this and marking all the squirrels on the way home or the habitats or, you know, looking at census data. There's all sorts of different ways that you could see this kind of data becoming a class project or something fun to do in your backyard or whatever. And so it's just another way of saying, hey, data, this is a fun data thing that's happening here, and how could we do a fun data thing for kids?
It would have been fun if the census was like, go to your corner and check in.
Right, exactly. I'm the mayor of my house. And I have 2.3 children.
So in putting up images from Halo, I kind of gave away what this map is to an extent, though you're probably going, how in the world is this crazy, weird, brain scan-ish looking image related to Halo? And so on the your right, keep doing this, is a heat map that Bungie, the developers of Halo and many other games, they publish these heat maps of how, they publish tons of data of how you're playing in the game. And or of what's going on in the game, these aggregated information. And in this particular case, this is showing information of the number of people who are killed by sniper fire. And the big red spot is where the most people are killed. And what it ends up being is there's like these ledges that people sit on. This is back to like the original Halo. There's these ledges in the world. I can't even remember which world it is right now. But anyways, there's these ledges. And people sit up there on the ledges. And like people spawn right at the base of these ledges, talk about bad design, and they just get picked off. And so these heat maps are really, it's just fascinating that Bungie thought to publish these, because it actually became part of the strategy for the game players to figure out how else they can play in the world, what they can do. If they're really particularly intent on sniping people, they can like find out where to go hang out. But it's also fascinating to hand that out to your users and be like, hey, here's a bunch of information that we know, use it how you want. It's also really interesting behind the scenes to think about it as usability information. And so if you're going into a period of time where you're testing and you're trying to figure out, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Like, presumably when they first got this data, they didn't know what was going on. And that big red splotch could be a whole bunch of people just getting stuck and not knowing what to do, as much as it could be this really like kind of quirky weirdness of people have just figured out that's a great place to sit and score kills. So the data can inform us as researchers as much as it can inform the player. And Halo is just a beautiful opportunity to do that. The middle image on the left was people who were playing at, what time was that? Yeah,
oh,
when I took that image.
It was like 10 o'clock at night, wasn't it?
Yeah, and yeah. So it's just, like, they just published this stuff where you can see the waves of, like, the East Coast logging in and then moving over to the West Coast.
It's like 10 o'clock Sunday night, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it's just kind of fun to play with stuff. To that point, progress metrics are one of these really dicey things in kids' games. Like, there is such a heavy emphasis on being educational and showing parents what's going on. So you see a lot of things like this Teach Me Toddler thing on the left, which is very, very just straightforward. Like, okay, your kid has played this much stuff. He's gotten these numbers right. And it's fine. It's not very contextualized. It's not very interesting. It may cause parents to freak out when they're like, oh my gosh, he got three shapes wrong. What is he doing? What does he know? What does he don't know? What does he not know? And I think there's some really cool opportunities to move into other things like the badges from Trism or any of these games. Like, yes, I know we're all sick of badges. Like, if my bank gives me another badge for like depositing 5 checks, I'm going to scream. I don't need that like aspect there, but I think this is like actually a cool opportunity to think about it differently and provide some information in a more contextual way, in a fun way that doesn't freak out the parent that the child's not learning, but also just presents the information in an interesting and thoughtful way.
And so moving on to kind of the literacy side of things, Words with Friends. It's very obviously a game about words and literacy. But one of the things we were thinking about is, can you imagine a version of this game where you actually gave teachers or parents or somebody access to try to get kids to form the kinds, to form words that they wanted to have them form? So say words beginning with a specific letter or using specific vocabulary words that the child's are trying to acquire so that you're really playing with the thing that you're supposed to be learning. And so this is another place where you could thoughtfully use badges to let kids know what they've achieved on specific tasks, specific vocabulary lists, without it getting kind of too like, yeah, you did five things, you get a sticker kind of thing. So now we're going to move a little bit into literacy and narrative.
And so this was, Anne was like, I can talk about the slide. I was like, no, I'm talking about this slide. I love interactive fiction. And if I could do nothing but this, I would bring like the old school Zork kind of world of things totally back. I love it. And I know what that says about me, but that said, I am putting it out there because I think there are fabulous opportunities to think around interactive fiction and the literacy opportunities that it offers to kids. And maybe not in this very old school black screen, white text, like just really, that's overwhelming for anybody who's not into it. But it's a great opportunity to think about comprehension, literacy, storytelling, and just all of those pieces that are really key to learning and loving reading, not just about learning letters and words, but that comprehension and understanding of what's going on.
So we're just going to sideline for a few minutes to just talk about what kids understand in terms of narration and stories, because this is important stuff to know as you're developing narrative experiences for kids. So kids in the sort of preschool area, 2 to 5, they're going to focus on the most physically obvious features of the environment. They're going to focus on the consequences of actions rather than the motivations. And this example is, so this dog is jumping into a pool. A kid is going to see this, a preschooler kid this age is going to say, the dog's going to get wet, right? They're not thinking about why the dog is jumping into the pool. And the other thing to know about children this age is they don't understand conventions that to us are very natural, like flashbacks or dream sequences. If you're going to move them from place to place, you really need to help them understand what's happening, or they're just going to be completely confused.
One of the reasons we bring this up is just because ebooks are so popular right now. Like, everybody's developing an ebook, which is great, but it's very natural to fall to the storytelling conventions that we all use every day. And realizing that if we're going to use those storytelling conventions, they need to be taught. Same as we all actually learned that a fade to black means a commercial is coming on TV. There's all of these bits and pieces that kids need to learn. And so especially if you're developing an ebook, which is often going to be for that preschooler or that early reader audience,
right,
there's a whole other set of considerations and storytelling to them that need to be taken into account.
Yep. And then the other thing sort of about this age is they're not very good at story sequencing. So if you were to show them three pictures, a vase on a table, a vase falling, and the vase broken on the floor, a kid this age would have a hard time putting those in the correct order of the narrative. They might put the broken on the floor, and then the falling, and then it's sitting on the table. So that's a challenging thing for children of this age. Now, as they get older, they start to get a grasp on some of these things. So they're starting to understand the plot, and they're understanding motives better. So now, at 5 to 8, a kid is going to look at this picture, an average child, and say, oh, look, there's those other dogs down there, and they have balls in their mouth. That dog is probably jumping in the pool to get a ball. So they start to be able to make those connections that aren't visible to them.
Oops, sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Who's driving?
Don't let the pigeon drive.
Don't let the Anne drive the PowerPoint.
If you have young kids, you'll understand that.
Yes, exactly.
We're a bit immersed in that world.
This is a child fiction. Sorry.
Are you catching up?
Yeah, I'm catching up. Sorry.
Okay.
So
I can put on polka.
Yeah, you can put on some polka. So anyway, by age 10, the kid is starting to get a sense of narrative that's a lot more similar to ours. So they're going to be able to remember a plot, they're going to be able to understand it the way an adult would, and they're going to be able to describe what's going on with someone less in terms of their external characteristics and have a greater emotional understanding. So the kid is not just going to say, that's Batman on the toilet, they're going to say, that's sad Batman on the toilet. So one example of a narrative game we really like is Surviving High School. Has anybody played this?
Oh, only one of the four.
Or are you only the one who's willing to admit that you played it? It's a little girly, but I love it. So it's this is sort of an interesting mix of kind of a choose-your-own-adventure-ish game, and it has some games embedded in it. But basically, you're starting at a new high school, and you pick your character, and then you're sort of moving through this story. Some of the pieces are already written out, and some of the pieces you're sort of helping to impact. And what's great about this is it's sort of a flip side of teaching really granular goals, like letters and vocabulary, really doing what Carla was just talking about, which is like fostering comprehension, fostering a love of literacy, letting the kid or go into the story and participate in it, and really put thought into the experience, which is going to be great for comprehension.
So the Night Circus, who's read the book?
Yeah, that's what I kind of thought. And so I'm going to assume that nobody has seen the game. Night Circus is this, it's a book that's, I think it's floating around on the bestseller list. It's really pretty big, and it's really kind of rambly and weird. And they made this really cool card game-ish online thing. And it's really actually neat once you've read the book. I looked at the game before I had read the book and was like, what the fuck is this? I had no idea what was going on. And then once I actually read the book, I was like, oh, this is the best card game ever. Like, I totally understand it. And I started playing it, and, like, it was the weirdest juxtaposition for me. I've never encountered a game where, like, beforehand, I just want nothing to do with it. And once I finish reading the contextualized part of things, I can't get enough. So they did something right, and they did something wrong in this case. But that the model and the mechanic based on this, it's not going to work for every book-based property, and I think there's amazing opportunities for extensions of books. But it was really a pretty cool one, and they're playing around with it and kind of seeing what they can do, so it's just neat. And I see a hand. What's up? This is like an adult book. Yeah. I think YA, young adults could read it without a problem. There is nothing particularly dicey about it, but it's really marketed to adults at this point. It's weird and rambly and very, like, exposition-y and descriptions of things that you're kind of like, why do I care about four pages on the tree? But it actually started as one of the National Novel Writing Month books, which, for those of you who have done that, it's 50,000 words in a month or a 50,000-word novel in a month, and people just end up writing all sorts of crazy stuff to get it going. So that kind of explains, like, the kind of feel of this book. It's very, like, whoa! Right. It's fun.
And then the other thing that's really interesting is sort of emotional cues and sort of coming into a story and pulling information out of emotional cues. And so L.A. Noire is great to look at for that. I assume a lot of people have played that, but maybe I'm wrong. These guys have played it, I'm sure. Yeah, so you're a detective, and you're going through these cases and interrogating suspects and investigating clues, but it's important to be able to read emotion. That's one of the things that is going to help you be successful. And so that's another just area that's it's part, really, of social and emotional growth for kids is starting to understand, as we were talking about in the guidelines, like what's going on in the heads of other people and that's different from what's going on in your own head.
I think it's important to acknowledge with L.A. Noire, they didn't do it great. Like, they made certainly a lot of steps toward this emotional read in the
right.
characters, but it's still not, like, we've got a long way to go, but yeah. It's definitely something to be reaching toward and working toward.
Right.
So that said, that brings us to the end of that portion. And really, as we got into this, it was very much about looking at the games that we play every day and that we enjoy as adults and thinking about kids, what their needs are, and really trying to think about what pieces we can take out of that and just finding inspiration in the things that we're playing every day, because kids' games are so much more than letters and numbers, so much more than matching games and these very, like, flashcard-based kinds of things, that there's a lot of opportunities to be had. And I think there's some really neat pieces of that. We can certainly, we have some time,
looks
like
10 minutes
for questions, if there are any, or if you want to go back to sleep, I understand. So, are you going to pick?
I'm going to pick.
So we don't end up with,
yes.
Okay.
Warren. You got to drive, I'm picking.
I'm looking at the Rockstar games. I actually came from the place. Uh-huh. My parents were big. Grand Theft Auto 3 came out when I was in middle school, and they had the big, no Grand Theft Auto in the house.
Right.
But it really did. What is your opinion on younger kids playing these more mature games?
Okay, since I promised I would repeat the question for everybody. So essentially he's saying that he grew up in a time when Grand Theft Auto was around, and when he played it, he learned and was exposed to things about the world, and just our thoughts about kids being exposed younger and younger to some of these very adult and mature themes and exposure to various things that we traditionally may not have wanted a younger kid to see.
Mm-hmm.
Fair? Okay. Yeah, it's a problem. And I think there are responsibilities all around. There's responsibilities of the game developers to actually, like, go after the ratings and to support the ratings. There's responsibility of
and
the teachers.
And to market to the audience that they actually say that they're marketing to, you know?
Yep, to market to the audience. It's a responsibility of the parents to actually have an awareness of what their kids are playing. They don't necessarily need to play it with them, but having an awareness and monitoring what they're playing and how much of it that they're playing and exposed to. And in the case of if there's a child who really, really is interested in playing some game that may be borderline for their interest, if that parent is willing to go there to actually play with them and have a dialogue about what's going on.
Yeah.
And so this idea of dialogic reading happens. It's a very natural part of how parents and children read books together, is that they have conversations about what's going on in the book. Reading a book does not have to be a linear experience of going page by page by page, but that you can stop and take these departures to talk about what's going on, what you see in the pictures, how that ties to the text, what underlying themes might be going on. And there's opportunities to do that with television. There's opportunities to do that with games, to stop, pause the action at a place that makes sense, talk about what you just saw, and situate it in this larger context so that it's either not so scary, that it's understood that it's a video game and that there's fiction going on. And I think that's...
It's a contextualized support, you know, and that's obviously something that we can't control, you know, whether or not that's there on our end. But I think that we all have sort of a general understanding that there's a big difference between going off and playing, you know, 400 hours of Grand Theft Auto in your friend's basement and never talking to your parents about it, and doing it in a context where maybe it brings up some thoughtful discussions, you know? So,
yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
I'm going to let you take this because this
is so on memory games. Yeah, and on memory games, there's a lot of differing approaches of how it can be done beyond just that like flip card kind of thing. And there's even different ways within that flip card support that you can do it. Without going too deep into that, I would say like, poke around the literature, like even using Google Scholar and just looking at some of the basic ideas of how kids' memory develops is probably the best place to start. I really am a big advocate for just using tools like that, for using parenting sites, for their parenting mm-hmm. sites, especially like the PBS Parents Child Development Tracker, has amazing information about kids 0 to 8 and across all dimensions how they're learning. And it's a really nice opportunity to get some embedded and smart information. On testing, so first of all, the biggest thing that you can do with testing with kids is that it's a larger sample size than you would normally use, because you need to account for, is this just a really advanced 4-year-old? Is this just a really, you know, behind 4-year-old? Is this a normal 4-year-old? And then, yes, there is this factor of as they're introduced to things, they do begin to grok things and you can get away from the information you're looking at. So it's also important, so beyond sample size, to also get a variety in terms of the audience. So actually asking more about what are their play patterns, what do they play, what are they familiar with. Yeah. We've gone into testing situations where we're looking at a 6-year-old and suddenly we find out they're like a level 40-something on World of Warcraft.
Right.
We're like, oh, this is so not the child that we need in this testing, and we need to essentially throw out their data.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to add, since there's a lot of developers here. Like the other danger is that there's a temptation on all of our parts, I think, to be like, oh, I know kids, I have kids, and there's kids in this group of game developers, and you got to keep in mind that group of people's children is way more technologically literate than the average child, and so you have a danger of throwing your data off far in the direction of sophistication.
So there was one, our buddies down here.
I'm curious about player goals. For most adult players, the goal seems to boil down to mastery at some level.
Uh-huh.
What are the player goals for sort of the different age groups? Why are they playing games?
Yeah.
So mastery is still a huge factor. In fact, why temper tantrums happen is because of mastery. That a two-year-old gets it in their head that they're going to move this pile to here. And if you get in the way of that, you have just stepped on their ability to master that situation. And so that's where temper tantrums happen. And so mastery is always a goal. That just like Fiero moment of like, yes, I did it, happens throughout and is always a goal. There's also sub-goals, though, or other goals of things like, for preschoolers, it's about playing with the characters. It's really about, you know, living in their world, having the chance to interact with them. As you move into older, it becomes more about socializing to an extent, to having, even if you're playing this game alone, it's then about going out to your friends and being able to talk about it in that, like, community and that just social aspect of, like, we all have this in common. So there's some other things like that that start to happen, but ultimately it still boils down to mastery.
Right, and I would say mastery also in more manageable chunks, you know? I mean, when you're mastering a big, complicated general audience game, that takes a really long time to do, and you just are doing it in smaller pieces to some degree. Mitchell.
Specifically, obviously World of Warcraft has huge collaborative, involvement.
Yeah.
So many, where I'm going. There's so many great things about World of Warcraft in terms of how it works, but at the same time, there's so much destruction that happens to the people who play it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, every game has, I may be in the wrong room.
Yep. And now Carla can talk about her dissertation.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we're out of time. So, the short of it. So it goes back to, in part, it is in part the people who are around that player being part of the community and understanding and helping them like not play to that point of addiction. There's having the dialogue around it. There's very weird things about addiction in games and how you talk about it and whatnot, and there's many, many other factors going into things of the situation and whatnot. And the thing I struggle with especially is that games have, like, yes, it's bad to play games 8 hours a day, but it's also bad to eat, like, 4 gallons of ice cream a day or to run on a treadmill for 8 hours a day. Like, there are so many things that fall into that aspect of addiction, and games just happen to have a really bad rap. And so I think there's this larger awareness of addiction and what it means and to be a support person to somebody who's in that situation. That said, these games like World of Warcraft or any of the ones that have this darker side that is challenging to some people, I think then it really does come back to some of these things of knowing who your player is, marketing to them and not to the people who are not yet ready intellectually or emotionally for the various things. And this is probably like 5 other talks that we could go down into this. So, are there other questions? Yes.
Just a question around useful knowledge and being able to abstract out into the game.
Mm-hmm. Learning real world skills. Well, the idea, what you're talking about is the idea of transfer,
right?
Which is not unique to games. Is this massive educational challenge of how do you take what you learn in a classroom? How do you apply just understanding what 2 + 2 is to being in the grocery store, of transferring it to those other situations? And it's a huge challenge. And it in part comes from the parents and the community around the child extending and recognizing that there's a learning opportunity going on and extending it into and helping them guide them through that into those other pieces.
I mean, the other thing I would say about it is also, though, I think that there's a temptation, because educational games are hot, to be like, we're going to use this game to teach kids how to read, you know, and we're going to use this game to teach physics or whatever. And you need to consider it a little more in the context of other learning opportunities as well. You know, that there's a great opportunities in games, but they don't do everything, and they don't do everything. What we like to think about a lot is, what's the best way? What are the best pieces of this curriculum that sync up well with games? not how do we cram this entire curriculum into a game, including all these pieces that really aren't best taught this way. So, you know, I think that that's something that we think about all the time. Anybody else? I think we're getting the high sign that we're almost
there. Oh, and there's... Yep.
Go ahead.
That's my daughter.
Yeah, our children are peppered throughout this PowerPoint.
So the first thing you're talking about is emergent gameplay, is really essentially like handing them a set of tools and seeing what they do with it, or the idea that they're going to just play with something completely different way that you intended. I love it when that happens. I think that actually means that I was accidentally did something really awesome, and that we're achieving the goals of not being so punitive as to say, like, no, this is the proper way to play my game. And there are certainly games where that is what you need to do. Like Tetris is one where, like, there's pretty much one way to play it. You could probably get a little like crazy artistic and, you know, add a few little layers to things. But that idea of adding, of letting them play with it in their own way in many situations is great. I mean, that's why we were talking about some of the sandbox kind of games of like Minecraft and whatnot. Giving them a set of tools and letting them run is fabulous.
And at the same time, giving them guidance so that they don't get stuck, you know? So if we're not doing something pure sandbox and they are going to get, they're trying to do something that's not the correct input, we also don't want them to get frustrated on the other side if nothing's happening because they're doing this cool thing. So we always are going to build in some support that's going to sort of remind the children what the instructions are, remind them what it is that they're supposed to be doing. And if they're not doing it, that's totally...
Right. You want them to play the game.
I don't necessarily want them to play the game, but I'm saying if that's your intention, you can also build in support for that.
Yeah. And so then on the gender thing, I get this all the time. I got it last week at Game Developers Conference. And here's the thing that I say that may or may not be popular, is that there's a point where, like, you can't please everybody. Like... The adult gaming market is a perfect example. Like, I don't want to play zombie games. Like, I'm just not interested in that. There's aspects of them that are really cool, but I really would much rather if there was some Left 4 Dead version where I'm, like, shooting rainbows at puppies or something. Like, I would just be so much happier.
And I do want to play zombie games. So there you go.
Power to you. Yeah. There comes a point where there is just a split. And one of the reasons why, like, when you're playing racing car games, that you can actually pick your car and decorate your car and, like, add these features to it is actually to try to bring the women into the fold. Right. And that's exactly what the designers realized, is they were like, men want to just give me a car, let me go. The women are like, I want to, like, decorate this a little bit and, like, pick and choose. And so that's a case where they were able to kind of bring those two things together. But there really comes a point where you're talking especially, like, tweens and teenagers who have become so self-aware and are so about figuring out their identity that crossing over into something that's perceived as something as being for someone else just hits a point where it doesn't work. And so I basically am like, you know what? It's okay to build different stuff. And yes, when you hit on something fabulous like Angry Birds that everybody wants to play, like, that's amazing. But it just is not the norm, and it's really, you're probably doing yourself a disservice to try to design to 100% of the audience rather than to know your audience who's going to enjoy it and design to them.
And we're being given a serious.
I can push
it. So we'll be around and we can.
Yeah, we're here. And you can always email us
if you guys want to chat further.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks a lot.